I wanted to speak about the broader Middle East, and I will touch on Israel and Palestine in a second, but I wanted to start off by giving up a couple of rather curious quotes that just came to mind as I was preparing this little talk. As the revolutions in the Arab world were starting off in January, Egypt, Tunisia, etc., there was an interesting quote in the Wall Street Journal. US official, my favourite term, which I'll come back to in a minute, told the journalists from that paper that they weren't looking for regime change as much as regime alteration. That was their quote, not mine. And the reason I think it's important we understand what regime alteration means, as we've just heard about Egypt, is that in much of the Arab world at the moment, Egypt, Tunisia, and many other countries, there has been profound change. However, in many of these countries, in fact, all these countries, there has only been regime alteration thus far. Leaders have fallen, certainly, and there is a process undergoing in Egypt and elsewhere to try and find some kind of democratic change, and hopefully that is successful. But we shouldn't underestimate, as we heard enough a minute ago, what exactly is going on over there. And the reason I think it's important for us to say that is that all these revolutions have happened despite what the West was trying, not because of them, despite what us, not us in this room, I'm presuming, but us as Western powers wanted to maintain. The status quo suits a lot of people, and Israel particularly, which I'll come back to in a moment. One of the interesting things about what's happened in the last few months has been the way in which Israel particularly has been affected. And on the one hand, this I think needs to be addressed in a few different ways. Let me address them one by one. The first thing which has been fascinating is how the Israeli government under Netanyahu, the Prime Minister, has framed Israel's future role, potential future role, after these regimes around Israel are changing. Ehud Barak, the defence minister, who was also prime minister about 10 years ago, was in New York a few months ago giving a few speeches, and he made a couple of interesting comments. He spoke to an IDF fundraiser, and those guys need a lot more money, clearly. And he was talking about, and I haven't got the direct quote in front of me here, but I remember it quite well. He says, "Israel is an island of stability in a dangerous neighbourhood." And this is in some ways a line, a phrase, in fact, that Israel's been using since 1948. And in some ways, and in many ways, it's been incredibly successful to guarantee much Western support. So the idea that you have numerous Arab regimes which are, in inverted commas, unstable, although arguably much of the Arab world has been very stable because we've been backing dictatorships for 30, 40, 50, 60 years, is that Israel is more reliable because it's, in inverted commas, democratic. And what he was asking for and demanding from the US was namely more money and more arms and more weapons. And it became very clear, in fact, that very soon after the Mubarak regime fell, I should say Mubarak himself rather than the regime, the US Congress did decide to give Israel far more weaponry to maintain, in inverted commas, a qualitative military edge, which is the term that Israel has always demanded they must have against their regional neighbours and so-called enemies. And this became very clear late last year when the US Congress talked about selling $60 billion worth of arms to Saudi Arabia, that lovely democracy in the Middle East. And Israel was a bit upset about that, concerned that their qualitative military edge would be challenged. And the US Congress said, no, don't worry. And Obama said, no, don't worry. We're selling you guys the better stuff. Don't worry. We're selling them good stuff. To Israel, much better stuff. Much more deadly stuff, and we laugh, but the truth is that one realises very clearly, and I don't think this room point needs to be convinced of this, but Obama in this region has been an unmitigated disaster. A disaster. And he's been a disaster for two reasons. One, because much of the left, or should I say some on the left, not all, in the US, particularly during the last election campaign, not surprisingly wanted to not have a Republican president, who could have been John McCain or Sarah Palin, which would not have been ideal, I grant you that. But the way in which Obama was fated and the expectations put upon him to do certain things in a range of areas has led us to a situation now for two things. One, in much of the US, and there are notable exceptions, I grant you that, but in much of the US, the so-called left, so-called progressive movements, whatever, often have been paralysed to an extent. And you have not seen mass protests and outrage over many of the policies that has been continued from Bush. If one looks at a lot of the key issues in US foreign policy towards the Middle East, rendition, torture, Guantanamo Bay, occupation of Palestine, increased occupation of Afghanistan, maintaining the occupation of Iraq, increased drone attacks in Pakistan, I could go on, supporting Yemen, Egypt, I could go on. Ultimately, that has only continued. Now, yes, in the last few months, there have been some shifts in the Middle East because of people power, not because the US has assisted that. It's been the opposite of that. And in fact, one realizes that when one sees what the US and many Western countries wanted to happen in Egypt, if there was such a mass movement to unseat Mubarak, which there apparently, well, clearly there was, the aim of the West was to simply replace him with an equally pliable figure, Suleiman, the man that you mentioned before, who was has been identified by Mamdouh Habib, as all of you will know, an Australian citizen who was tortured in Guantanamo Bay and Egypt. Suleiman himself has been identified as one of the torturers of Habib, and he told me this myself, and he's written about it himself publicly, Habib has. And he's currently, Habib, through Egyptian human rights and lawyers in Egypt, pursuing a legal case against Suleiman and others who were complicit in human rights abuses, including torture. And one of the things that became clear was the Americans, and indeed the Australian government too, were pushing for Suleiman to replace Mubarak. He simply replaced one thug with another. And the WikiLeaks cables that emerged about this issue, which came out in about January, February, revealed a few things. One, there was literally a direct line from Israel to Suleiman's office in the past years. And Suleiman himself was key and central and vital to maintaining the siege on Gaza, which often we forget this when we talk about a siege. It was maintained and remains being maintained by Israel and Egypt. This is not just an Israeli issue, it's an Egyptian issue. And the Egyptian new regime, quasi-military establishment, have said that the Gaza border will open in the next couple of weeks. Let's wait and see if that actually happens. There's been talk about it, there's been questions about it. I'm skeptical if it's going to happen because Egypt is clearly wanting to maintain the $1 to $3 billion of aid they receive from the US annually, which is mostly arms and military support, which you'd have to say would be under question if the border towards Gaza is opened. One of the things that also became so clear looking at the relationship between Israel towards the Arab world is, and I've said this for a number of months, and I think it's a statement, really a fact rather than an opinion, for Israel to maintain its position in that region, to maintain an occupation and anti-democratic norms, it can only do that with dictatorships around it, Arab dictatorships, client states. You cannot maintain the infrastructure of apartheid that exists in Israel, let alone in Palestine, unless you have client states around you. Now, obviously, the role of America is key. The role of EU is key. The role, obviously, of Australia is less key, but not unimportant. But to have states like Egypt and Jordan and Saudi Arabia, all at various degrees of friendship with Israel, that allows you to give the impression of friendship. But in fact, it's essentially the West paying those guys to maintain friendship with you. The only reason the Mubarak regime and the regime Abdullah in Jordan are friends with Israel is because they're getting paid by the US for the friendship. So I can get paid to be friends with people too. If you pay me, I'll be friends with anyone. But ultimately, it's about saying, how do you maintain friendship? And that's why that when the US and Israel were so petrified of the Mubarak regime falling, one of the few leaders who came out right at the end saying publicly, Mubarak's a good guy, he needs to stay, was Israel. Saudi Arabia said it too, but they would. Was Israel. And I think it's important, although most people in this room probably take this as a statement of fact anyway, but it's important that we understand what that says about the Israeli democracy, I use that term very advisedly, compared to states in its neighbourhood. And one of the things that's become very clear and hopeful in a way is the possibility of things changing in Palestine itself because of what's happening around the region. Now, at the moment, there was talk, there was hope, there was pressure to try and bring some kind of mass movement of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza to protest in the hundreds of thousands of people. The idea being that if that actually happened, Israel wasn't going to mow them all down, you'd have to presume. It would cause a momentum that would be very difficult to not bring some kind of change. And you know this is a fear because in the Israeli press, which I read for my sins every day, there are regular articles talking about the Israeli state could not handle that. They wouldn't know what to. The world's media would be watching. What are they going to do? Shoot 100,000 people? Obviously not. So what are they going to do? And the hope is, I have a hope, and many people in Palestine as well, not all, but many, that there is some kind of mass movement to mirror what is happening elsewhere, because politically speaking, the political reality in Palestine with Hamas and Fatah is a complete debacle. And although there was a reconciliation of sorts this week in Cairo, there was a deal struck between Hamas and Fatah, the details of that deal are very, very troubling. And without wishing it, we can talk about it more if you guys want to in Q&A, but the details of that don't bring some kind of liberation to Palestine. Yes, it's better that the groups are friendly than not, true, because that gives the ammunition to the West to say, the Palestinians themselves can't get their shit together, so therefore why should we speak to them? Yes. So it's important that Hamas and Fatah are friendly of sorts, but the deal that they have struck doesn't do anything to address the fact that the Palestinian Authority has become essentially a colonial tool of Israel. Israel has been training with America, I might add, Palestinian Authority troops in Jordan for the last 5 years, under Bush first, now under Obama, to maintain the occupation, to continue it. It's a classic colonial relationship where, this has happened in numerous countries in the last 60 years, where you get so-called friends who you pay to manage your occupation for you. You manage the situation. That's exactly what the PA has been doing in Palestine, in the West Bank. And Hamas, on a separate question, I was in Gaza about a year and a half ago, without wishing to go into detail about the situation in Gaza. There's no doubt that this brings a question for many of us in the West who support resistance in some way, how we deal with a group like Hamas. How do we feel about Hamas? Do we sort of see them as resistance fighters? Some are, many are not. Do we look at how they're ruling Gaza? And yes, they're under occupation, there's a siege. I'm not minimising any of that, and I saw that with my own eyes. But the reality is that Hamas as a party, many Hamas people are doing things in Gaza which we should not support. And what I mean by that is a number of different things, and briefly I'll say what they are. One, talking about the way in which women's rights have been severely restricted. Freedom of speech has been restricted. The rights of journalists has been severely restricted. Now, yes, you could argue, as many do, that in the environment within Gaza, which is under siege, things aren't going to be normal. I accept that. However, we shouldn't, as progressives or whatever we want to call ourselves, not address and accept that there are troubling things about what Hamas is doing in Gaza today. Let me just say a few last things before I wrap up, because then we can have Q&A. One of the things that WikiLeaks, and this ties into what's happening in the Arab world, of course, is an interesting quote that Assange has often talked about, and I'm paraphrasing what he says here, but I'll say it anyway, is that why in 5 years of his website being around, it started in late 2006, why in 5 years has one website had more leaks than all the corporate press combined for the last 30 years? And the simple answer is, I don't know, except the longer answer, a bit longer answer, is that it says a hell of a lot why someone like Manning, who we apparently think, possibly, maybe, leaked those documents to WikiLeaks, why he wouldn't have gone to the New York Times. Why wouldn't he go to The Guardian? Why wouldn't he go to a major newspaper? Now, we don't know the simple answer why he hasn't been interviewed. We don't know that. Why? And I have views about why that might be, but I think there is a sense that what WikiLeaks had been doing before Manning took over, what WikiLeaks was doing before Manning leaked those documents to them was actually showing all the information about stories as opposed to most of the corporate press that does not. And one of the things Assange often talks about is this so-called scientific journalism, which is revealing all one's sources about how a story is formed. So when, for example, you look at all the cable gates, the ones that have been released, Afghan logs, Iraq logs, countless other documents, you can see the original information upon which the stories have been based. Most journalists don't do that, and you realise the biases of how the corporate press reports. When a lot of the Afghan-Iraq war logs were released last year in the New York Times and The Guardian, the civilian casualty question, which is key to what those documents said, was massively downplayed in the New York Times. It was talked up more in The Guardian and in papers in Europe, but certainly in The New York Times it was downplayed. The main focus, principally, was the issue of Pakistan playing a double game, which is not untrue, as we're seeing this week with the death of bin Laden, which I'll get to in a minute briefly. But the key point also is civilian casualties are clearly central to understanding what is being done in our name. Let me just finish to briefly say a few things about bin Laden because, well, no one said anything yet and I want to. So I think what's fascinating about the... And I say apparent death of bin Laden, not because I think that he's somehow living still in a cave or living, you know, down the road, is that we, as far as American, US officials tell us that he's dead, and the history of US officials telling us things isn't particularly accurate, and it's not made easier by the fact that this week their stories change every day about five times. Who was killed, when they were killed, where they were shot, who was shot, etc. So let's presume for a second, for argument's sake, that OBL is dead. But what I think it says principally is how much of the coverage that we've seen about this challenges the idea of the mainstream narrative, which completely goes against what's happening in the Middle East. For anyone who looks at the Middle East and spends time there, the appeal of bin Laden is minimal at best. The people who often supported bin Laden in the Arab and Muslim world did so not necessarily, except for a small few, of course, who supported more extreme terrorist acts, did so because of dissatisfaction with often the leaders that we were supporting, the wars that we were supporting. It doesn't justify, in my view, suicide bombing anywhere, for example, but it explains it partly. And I think what the Arab revolutions have done, have shown and continue to show in much of the Arab world is the way in which bin Laden's ideology and what he stands for, which is a very hardline Islamist view, is being challenged by a range of people, millions of people, secular, Islamist, religious, non-religious, who are saying to their leaders and to us as Westerners who often supported those regimes that in fact what matters in the end is not an extremist ideology but independence from us. And although the Egyptian revolution wasn't principally about Palestine or Iraq or Afghanistan, it was about liberation for Egypt, but those who ignore the fact, and I'm sure you'll be able to say this yourself having been there recently, is that those issues were not unimportant to those revolutions. How we in the West treated and continue to treat that part of the world is central to understanding what resistance is about. And again, the question of what resistance means in the Arab world these days, whether we like these groups or not, whether it's Hamas, Hezbollah, elements within Iran, and they're all, in my view, major problems with those countries or groups. However, they have social roots in the communities. The reason Hezbollah has so much power in Lebanon isn't because simply it's terrorizing people, it's because it's spent years and years and years. If you spend any time in Lebanon, you see this, that they have been building relationships in the community, for better or worse. It is what it is. Let me just finish with two brief points. The WikiLeaks issue and the Arab revolutions, I think, also show clearly the vast and growing gap between public opinion and state opinion. If you look at public opinion polls in most countries, including even in America, although America is always an elephant in the room on many issues, Palestine, Afghanistan, Iraq, WikiLeaks, the profound separation between what the government themselves believe and what the Australian government or the American government believe. WikiLeaks is one good example, and I'll finish with this. When our dear Prime Minister late last year said that Assange and WikiLeaks had committed an illegal act without any evidence, which is what our government does very well, it was made very clear that in public opinion poll after public opinion poll, WikiLeaks and Assange received support, a lot of support, majority support. And the reason for that isn't because they necessarily liked Assange particularly, I'm sure some do. It's because Assange is rightly seen, in my view and many people's view, as someone who simply doesn't accept a state-run view and, more importantly, the corporate news view. And what Assange always says over and over and over again is, Why have you not been told this as a general public, what we're telling you? Why are you relying in some ways on us? He's sort of throwing the question back to us as citizens. Why are you having to rely on us to get leaks when your journalists aren't doing the job that they're told they're supposed to do?